Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
Max and friends, he says what he wants, ain't holding nothing back.
LA Talk Radio. This is Max and Friends. I'm your host, Max Fucci. Welcome back to another Sunday night of Max and Friends. So tonight, I've just got to send all of my love out to Liz Smith. She passed away today in New York at the age of 94 years old. But you know, to yin, there's yang. To life, there's death. And to death, there's life. And to yang, there's yin. So tomorrow is our girl Whoopi Goldberg's birthday. So happy birthday, Whoopi Goldberg. I still have a present I got to get you from my buddy at Crystal Pipes. But here's the deal. Tonight on Max and Friends, we're going to do a tribute show to the great Liz Smith. Liz and I, we knew each other. You know, I grew up in New York, and obviously with the restaurant, Liz Smith was a part of it. She was at Delmonico's often. She was friends with our family. And it was so sad. Naomi Campbell, I saw tweeted, Instagrammed that she had passed. And I was like, what? And yeah, it's true. So Mary Elizabeth Smith was born in 1923 in Fort Worth and grew up enthralled by the radio broadcast of Walter Winchell. I love that. Aching for the glamour and the excitement of New York, she said she was not interested in Hollywood. New York was where the luster was. And she arrived in 1949 to New York with like $50 and no job prospects, right? She's got an amazing life. And she quickly found her way, landing an apartment with two roommates, taking turns sleeping on the couch. The place was small, but it did not matter. The city was too exciting for her to stay home and read or sleep, knowing what was outside her window. Stars, celebrities, the El Morocco, and of course, Delmonico's. I was just climbing and electrified all the time, she said, burning up with ambition. So I didn't want to judge other people too harshly that I see on television. They're just climbing also, but I like to think that I had some talent. Well, Liz Smith had a lot of talent. She's going to be tremendously missed. And tonight here on Max and Friends, we're going to play a tribute show to Liz Smith. It was one of my favorite Charlie Rose interviews with Liz Smith. So just every time we say her name, her energy is felt. And remember, for this soul, there is neither birth nor death. It is eternal and everlasting, just like love. So I send my love to everyone who loved Liz Smith and loves Liz Smith. I send my love to you. Tonight, here we go. We're going to play the tribute show. And then what's fun is that coming up, we have one of my best of shows with Rutanya Alda from Mommy Dearest. Rutanya has her book. So stay tuned to that. And tweet me at Max Tucci. Let me know what's going on in your life. Of course, you could find me now on Instagram, Max Tucci Radio. Max Tucci Radio on Instagram. Join me there. And hi, Meganella. Thanks so much for tweeting me. Oh, y'all heard. I know I'm getting texts and tweets and this and that. Eva LaRue came out with her story about Steven Seagal. So I think Eva's going to join us in the studio soon and maybe we'll be able to talk about it. So, this is what I have to say. Respect. Just have respect for yourself. Have respect for others. Be kind to yourself. Be kind to others. And, we'll leave it at that. So, but I want you to know that everyone, your life is big. So please keep reaching this week. When you go into this week, just celebrate life as we celebrate Liz Smith tonight here on Max and Friends. So right now, Liz Smith tribute show, and then stay tuned for Rutanya Alda. I'm going to say good night and good karma to you, but know that staying tuned to Max and Friends is where you need to be. And also, if you don't have the LA Talk Radio app by now, please go get it. It's for free at the LA Talk Radio App Store, which is on all the stores. There you can find the App Store. You can find in Play Store. You can find the LA Talk Radio app. It's free. And you could take us to bed with you. Well, you could take me to bed with you every Sunday night here on Max and Friends. I don't know if the rest of the hosts here on LA Talk Radio are going to want to sleep with you, but maybe they will. Maybe you want to sleep with them. Whatever it is, get the app because that's free and that's for sure. And if you don't like it, you can delete it. And if you love it, you can tell your friends. But I also want to tell you that life is beautiful. So thank you for tuning in, and tweet me at Max Tucci. We did that. If you want to email me, max@maxtucci.com. Let's stay in touch. Let's stay connected. Let's have conscious conversations. Oh, and happy belated birthday to Gordana Biernat, who celebrated just the other day, and my sister as well. So happy birthday, you all Scorpions. All right, I'm going to go now. So good night, good karma, but don't go anywhere. Stay tuned, because right now, as we celebrate life, we celebrate Liz Smith on LA Talk Radio, Max and Friends. I'm your host, Max Tucci.
Liz Smith is here. The gossip maven has been called the Grand Dame of Dish. She was born in Fort Worth, Texas, where she worshipped the movies and listened to Walter Winchell on the radio every Sunday night. In 1949, she left for New York City with $50 in her pocket and a one-way bus ticket in hand. Her work for CBS Radio and Cosmopolitan and Sports Illustrated led to her own gossip column in 1976. She has covered and befriended everyone from Rock Hudson to the Kennedys, from Frank Sinatra to Madonna. Her new book is Natural Blonde, a memoir, and I am pleased to have her back on this program. Welcome back.
Thank you, Charlie. Good introduction.
We got it
sexy.
Right, didn't we? Yeah, sexy. This is a great picture.
Well, when you get to be my age, yeah, how you look is really paramount.
Do you care?
Oh,
that's
yeah,
very
I care.
Nice, though.
I'm look. Very vain,
yeah,
like
who
most
took
women.
This?
A marvelous young guy named Alex Cow.
Yeah.
And he was taking pictures for my hairdresser for a book. And he took that picture of me, and I said, wow, I'll save that for my memoir because I'll never have a better one.
Let me take you back to Texas, growing up there.
Okay.
Your father, gambler?
He was an incredible gambler. He just loved it.
Yeah.
He loved to shoot craps. He loved to play roulette. He liked to play blackjack. He loved to play the horses. You know, I've got a story in the book about my mother crying. She bringing the mail in saying, I just don't think it's right to get the racing form and the Baptist Standard in the same mailbox. That was my life as a child. Torn between these two opposites.
Closer to one than the other?
Well, I always worshipped him. He was really exciting and dynamic and ambitious and energetic, and my mother was more sort of a Southern Belle, real mother. She was like, you call Central Casting, send me the perfect-looking mother. That's what she was.
Your dad called you best boy, my best boy.
Well, he had three children, two boys and me, and I was the one who would try and please him the most. So he'd always say, you're my best boy. I guess it didn't do me any good, Charlie. In the long run. Caused me a lot of trouble.
What do you mean?
Gender misidentification.
Yeah.
Down the line. No, I don't know that it had anything to do with anything. I mean, a lot of people probably have had that.
You were a tomboy, in fact. As a lot of people were in Texas.
I was a coward, though, but I always tried to not show it because I wanted to please him. So I would get on these massive 16-hand horses and do things that were just terrifying. He loved horses.
Yeah. The movies was your view of the outside world.
Right. I thought there was really some place where Fred and Ginger were dancing on a black glass floor, and if I just looked, I could find that place. And I did find it, in a manner of speaking. I finally
found it in New York City.
Yeah, I finally found it. I found it. It was here. It was the Rainbow Room. It was the Stork Club, El Morocco, 21, you know, all those great old places.
But you listened to Walter Winchell on the radio in Texas.
Oh, I did. I don't know why, but he was just so compelling to me. You know, he would do things that I thought were so great. Like he would sign off, he'd say, and now I want you to remember that this is Mrs. Winchell's little boy, Walter, who can tell you that it may be un-American to, you know, spit on the swastika, but why shouldn't you? But it's the American thing to do. He would say these stupid sort of turnaround epigrams. I thought they were great. I thought they were really important.
When you went to the University of Texas, were you thinking about journalism or just end up that way?
No, I sort of ended up that way. I'd had an unhappy marriage and not unhappy, just failed, total failure. My father offered to send me back to college, so I went. But I didn't know what I wanted to do. I think I sort of subliminally was always trying to do some form of journalism because that's what I opted for.
You wanted to be a star or be with stars, fair to say?
I think that's a fair assessment of my ambitions. I mean, I know it's a mighty puny thing when we really examine it, but I think I did. I think I wanted to know famous people.
When you came, got on that bus to come to New York, we'll stay at Texas for a second there. I mean, there is now the thing that you have been writing about and talked about that caused great trauma for you, you know, after failed marriage.
Right.
Fell in love with...
I fell in love with a young woman at the University of Texas, and I had this sort of star-crossed lover romance, emotional Sturm und Drang, and our families became involved in it, and it was a very unhappy time for me, for
and
everybody.
For her. And for her.
Yeah, well, probably.
Probably.
But certainly for our parents, because I think no parent is just sitting there, even today, waiting, hoping their kids will come home and say, hey, I'm in love with a person of the same sex, and nobody wants
to deal
with that. Your dad
didn't speak to you for all summer?
No, and I ate at the dinner table with him every night, and he would never look at me or speak to me. But I wanted to go back to school, and I was really dependent on him, and I was financially dependent on him. I was still, you know, a real adolescent. I hadn't grown up at all. And I just had encountered puberty. And
Raging hormones.
Raging hormones. So anyway, yes. I was determined to stick it out. And my brother Bobby, who is the love of my life, was just, he would come in and tell horrible, funny, racist, silly jokes and make everybody laugh and try to take the curse off of this situation.
There is the story, you're riding back in the car and you're in the back seat sitting with Bobby, and he says, quoting that great Latin expression, which is translated, don't let the bastards get you.
Yeah, don't let the bastards wear you down. And I think that was when I cried, because his support was so wonderful. He was only about 16 or 17, but he was a smart kid.
When later you went into therapy way in New York in the 80s, I guess it was, and it made all the difference in the world. Did you go all the way back to this? I mean, did you finally come to grips with all that, or had you long forgotten it?
You know, my therapist, Mildred Newman, who is a wonderful woman, whatever she may say in defense of herself, she always was trying to get her many gay, confused, homosexual patients to straighten up and fly right. And she would always try to tell you that you didn't have these feelings. But it
doesn't sound like a very wise...
So I didn't deal so much with that. Yeah. By the 80s...
Yeah, but she made a difference for you, did she?
Yes, I was more concerned with work. How could I be a success? I wasn't there for my love life then.
This was not about whatever my personal life is. So you get on a bus and...
No, we, of course, addressed it, but I didn't see any real virtue in trying to figure out why all of that happened. And why it continued to happen to me periodically. You know, I mean, I finally decided I was just gender blind. I really like men. I really like women. I didn't ever know quite what to do about it.
This is not a violation of confidence. I remember once having, when I came to New York, a conversation with you, and you said about that to me, something
did
about
I?
Like that. You said, I like
my
men
goodness.
And I like women at different
You mean
times.
I fessed that up to you, Charlie?
Yes, you
I
did.
Must have adored you.
You told me. But
it wasn't easy for me to address this, Charlie.
Even among your friends?
I like to think of myself as a absolutely perfect person who never confused, never made any mistakes. No, all of my friends have known all of my trials and turmoils, most of my close friends. And in fact, I naively assumed that this wouldn't even make a ripple in
the book.
Yeah, I didn't really think of it.
And everybody wanted to describe this book as Liz is coming out. That was the great secret that's going to be in this book. And that's the reason that the publisher would not let anybody get their hands on it until 60 Minutes did their piece.
Well, actually, I don't know that the publisher even thought there was anything very sensational in it. I think we were just trying to accommodate 60 Minutes, and you know, they're tough customers.
They
say you'll do it our way, or it's our
we
way
want
or the
our, we
highway.
We want our exclusive.
That's but that's why I said to New York Magazine, I didn't think I'd ever been in.
And you never thought you'd been in the closet so you couldn't come out?
Yeah, I mean, I had always had all of these switching around and so forth, and loath to describe myself. Still I am.
Well, why should you?
Refuse to.
Well, I mean, why should you? So you come to New York on the bus.
Right.
You don't have much money.
I wasn't so worried about that. I could type. I could type 80 words a minute.
And plus you had Zachary Scott's promise.
Well, I didn't think about that, you know. I had forgotten it. And I'm walking along the street one day reading the Daily News or something. And there's an item. Movie actor Zachary Scott and his beautiful wife, Ruth, were entertaining in a dinner party on their Central Park West. And I thought, I didn't know Zachary Scott, who I had interviewed in college, lived in Manhattan. I was stunned. I was just like all hicks. I thought every movie star lived in Hollywood. So I stepped into a phone booth, found a nickel, called him, and he answered. Actually, I called information and got his number.
And he answered.
I was so naive and wet behind the ears that was the kind of thing I thought I could do, and I did. And he said, Liz, oh my goodness, well, you're such a great writer. Just call my friend Chuck Saxon in the morning at 11 o'clock at Modern Screen. I know he'll give you a job.
And he gave you a job?
He did. I took my work. I took the Zachary Scott story that I'd written in college to Mr. Saxon, who you may know later became a very famous cartoonist for The New Yorker. Mm. And he said, you have a very virile writing style. And I said, thank you. And I had no idea what that meant. I went home and looked it up in the dictionary.
It certainly sounds good, though. So you then...
I knew it was a compliment. Yeah,
but when you arrived in New York and you opened the window of that hotel room, you knew this was your city. You felt...
I don't know that I really... I felt that I was on a track that I couldn't get off, but I don't know that I so much felt it. Things have happened to me by indirection. I really came to New York because I had this girlfriend and boyfriend in college that I was close to, and they wanted to get married. And her mother wouldn't let her go to New York unless she had someone to live with, like a chaperone, and I was elected. Little did her mother know what she was doing.
But didn't your brother come up?
And I came because of those two people.
Yeah. Your brother came up and was a roommate for a while?
Later he came, yes. I lived with him a little later.
When did gossip become the thing that you knew you would do?
Oh, I never did know I would do it. And when the Daily News came to me in 1976, they came to me in 1974 and said, we want you to do a gossip column for us. Your friend Rex Reed says you're the person to do it. And I'm saying, get out of here. Nobody wants to read gossip. 2 years later, they came back and made me the same offer. And I thought, am I crazy? I'll have a big byline. I'll make money. I'll get good seats in restaurants. So I did take it on. And it was just the opening gun of the infotainment age.
Yeah.
People Magazine was invented. Right after that, USA Today came into being, all of these entertainment magazines. And then television, of course, became the great endless maw for celebrity, using up celebrities at such a clip that we don't have any stars anymore. We just have celebrities.
No big stars.
Not like the studio
used to make
them.
Not like Elizabeth and Richard Burton and...
You know, Katharine Hepburn is, and Elizabeth Taylor, about the last two really big ones.
And Katharine Hepburn, you go to her house with some red boots.
Yes,
she says,
those are the ugliest things I've ever seen. Take them off.
And you threw them in your closet and never wore them again?
I've never worn them again. I ought to auction those off for charity. I think I will.
You've made them famous.
Lots of people ask me if I've still got them.
Katharine Hepburn said, why do you write that drivel?
Yes, she says, how can you stand to do what you do? I don't do a very good imitation
of Miss
Hepburn, but yeah. She's so amazing, an amazing, incredible woman.
And the answer you would give to her is what? I love it.
It's
about
laugh.
People. It's fun.
I said, well, Miss Hepburn, I want to write a whole piece about you for Vogue magazine about your book. And she said, all right. So we did it. I mean, she's pretty much got the picture. Her thing in life is to sort of put everything down that isn't of total first-rate quality. And I'm afraid, Charlie, that you and I know that first-rate quality is rare. And Miss Hepburn knows it, too.
Miss Hepburn is an extraordinary creature.
Yes. She lived by her own rules, and you know, she had her own verities, and she's an amazing woman. She said men and women shouldn't live together. They should live next door and visit.
Well, she sort of made it work in an interesting way.
Well, she finally, in the end, was more devoted to Spencer Tracy than any wife could ever be to anyone.
I just interviewed Peter O'Toole in London, and he told me a story about her, A, and John Wayne. It was an interesting story. But he also told me that he once saw she and Spencer, and they just were somewhere in a convertible. And he didn't want to go over because they looked so content. And they were watching a sunset. And he said, you could just tell these were two people magnificently in love. It's clear.
I think it's really true. I mean, she's such an interesting inspiration. When I go places, I feel I have an aura that I don't deserve, that I ever knew, have even known Miss Hepburn. And I wouldn't want to exaggerate my relationship with her. But I met her because of our mutual friend, Cynthia McFadden, who was sort of her godchild. And so I think she just suffered the people that Cynthia would bring to dinner. Cynthia would take me and Barbara Walters, and we'd go to dinner there once a week for a long period of time. And I think Miss Hepburn was just sort of amused by us. We were such fools, all of us.
Was she interested in politics? Was she interested in sports? Was she interested in Hollywood? What was she caring
about? No, she wasn't. And she didn't want you to bring anything into the room with you. She didn't want you to bring a sweater and put it down. She didn't want you to bring an umbrella or a briefcase. She had her idea about how the room should be pristine and uncluttered. And if we would talk, as we frequently did, of like, you know, Barbara would say to me, or I would say to Barbara, well, we saw Brooke Astor this week. And then she would say, who is that? And then Cynthia would say, well, Katie, you know that Mrs. Astor, we saw her down in Florida.
Yeah.
But she would always pretend she didn't know what we were talking about. And if we said we had to go somewhere, she'd say, oh, I'm so glad I don't have to go there.
She played golf for a long time, didn't she? She was a great golfer.
Yes, you know, in a funny way, one of the physical tragedies of Miss Hepburn's life was that she broke her ankle in a car accident. And she was this fabulous natural athlete, probably one of the greatest ever. And she couldn't, you know, carry on after that like she had done, so she had to quit. She still played tennis, but she couldn't play golf.
Friends. Throughout your life is this notion of friends. Mm. On the one hand, you have great friends and you write about them. On the other hand, you take great umbrage when you think people have mistreated your friends. And if they do, you will take after them in print.
Well, as I've said, Charlie, when Vanity Fair did the Proofs questionnaire with me, I said the most overrated virtue was loyalty. And I think in a way it is. I think it's almost a flaw with the kind of crowd I know in New York. They all line up and stand in front of each other to keep each other from being hurt and so forth. So I've bought into some of that, I guess.
You think it's an overrated virtue?
I do.
Why, to be loyal to your friends?
Yeah, but I think sort of telling, for a journalist, to be in a position where you can never really examine or tell the total truth is not a good thing.
Yeah, the rule of journalism is don't write about your friends. I mean, don't write about them because you have friendships, but don't write about them. But you cannot afford not to.
No, I don't. And also, I don't have to live by the rules other people do. I don't have to be pure like you and Mike Wallace and Tom Brokaw and Dan and all you guys.
Diane.
Yeah, I can just go to hell in a handbasket.
There is about you this. You love this notion. Someone said to me, Kris Kristofferson once said about Willie Nelson, he loves being an outlaw. You love the notion that you are a part, that somehow Liz Means stands by a different set of rules because she is, right?
This is a self-defined thing.
Yes.
Oh, brilliant of you, Charlie, to figure that out. I'm just a jerk. I mean, I just defined my own rules, and I wouldn't say they were always right. I say in the book that I haven't always been totally ethical and kosher, and I have bent the rules a lot. I said in the book that the thing I deplored most in people in the Proofs questionnaire, I said, was the fudging the ethical line. And then what did they said, what do you deplore most about yourself? And I said, fudging the ethical line. Because I think it's true.
Yeah.
You know, nobody can write every day 90 lines a day like I do, 6 days a week, and then do television too, and you're covering entertainment, and you're covering famous people, and always have the exact right.
But it's using the power of what you do. Three ratio. Examples. Sinatra would say things about your friends and would abuse, in your judgment, had abused your friends, and so you attacked him for being a bully. Red?
I
yes?
did. I thought he was a bully, and particularly to women, though he sometimes attacked men that I would defend, too. Like, he said Tom Brokaw should turn in his press card, and he had Jonathan Schwartz fired for breaking a release date. And I just couldn't stand that. I loved Sinatra as an artist, but I did stand up to him.
And then,
you know, he got... I think he just got bemused. People told him I was okay kind of person, that he was wrong about me. And so after making me famous all over the world by attacking me, he got interested. I think he was interested that I wasn't afraid of him. So he wanted to meet me, and he arranged a meeting
dinner.
With Sid Zion. No, not a
dinner.
We just had lots of drinks.
Yeah.
And we met in Jimmy Weston's, and he was like the most charming.
Boy, you can be charmed,
sexy.
You know? You can be charmed.
I can.
Richard
if
Nixon.
People are nice to me. I
at Malcolm Forbes' funeral.
No, I wasn't charmed by him. I felt sorry for Mr. Nixon. There he was.
He'd been sending you drinks at restaurants.
Wine. Used to try to send me in Le Cirque, but I didn't need him to send me wine in Le Cirque. That was Coles to Newcastle.
Yeah, but that's a nice gesture.
Yes, well, I think the thing was that in those last years, Richard Nixon was very lonely, and he wanted to rehabilitate himself, of course, in a large way, and he did, or tried to, in his books. But he thought that he knew people he saw on television, and he would charge over and say, "Hello, how are you? Do they pay you a lot for what you do on television?"
No,
he would say these silly things. But, I mean, I was embarrassed by him at Malcolm's funeral.
You were?
Well, I was sitting with Mrs. Astor, and he turned around and said, "Liz, how nice to see you. A wonderful story Time magazine just did on you." And then he didn't even speak to Mrs. Astor, and he turned back around. Then he turned back around and said, "Oh, Mrs. Astor, I'm sorry, I didn't see you. Did you see the great story Time did on Liz?" Well, by now, I was ready to pass out with embarrassment in the first place. We were about to have a funeral. It was, you know, solemn. And he was just talking like he was at a cocktail party.
So it
no,
wasn't,
I wasn't
you wasn't charmed,
charmed
or seduced or anything?
Not really.
Did you like it when you heard that Warren Beatty said, "The one woman I wish I could sleep with"?
Well, of course I like that. I loved Warren Beatty. I'd always liked him. He and I are friends, sort of. Yeah. I like Warren. Impossible to write about him, though. You can't ever get anything out of him. He never tells you anything that you want to know.
There was also the story of Rock Hudson.
Well, Rock Hudson.
Where you felt, this is a friend of mine.
I was just like every person in the world, Charlie. Every woman in the world who ever met Rock Hudson fell for him like a ton of bricks. He was so charming and sweet. And we didn't know from gay guys back in the 50s. And I never knew Rock Hudson was gay. Or even thought about it. And when I was in Rome and he was making a farewell to arms, I just really always thought maybe I had a chance with him.
You thought you had a chance?
I did. I was, you know, full of beans and ego. And of course, and then later when I realized that he wasn't interested really in women. I mean, he liked a lot of women, but in fact, he really liked Elizabeth, and he liked...
And she was a great friend to him.
She was a great friend. But by the time that I knew his story, I still had never, ever mentioned it to him, and he had never mentioned it to me. He never said anything to me. And
about the fact that he was gay. Yeah.
And then he called me and said, "Liz, a woman is trying to blackmail me. She wants $250,000 not to give a story." And I guess he said to the National Enquirer, I can't remember now. And I said, "I know this woman. She's no Rose herself." And I said, "Let me look into this." And so I looked through some of my files, and I sent him my file on her. Why I had it, I don't know. And he showed it to her, and she faded away. But that was not an attempt to whitewash him or say he wasn't gay. He and I didn't discuss
it. Was that one of those cases where you thought, on second thought, maybe I shouldn't have done that? That was taken, that was crossing the...
I felt blackmailing her was justifiable. And
so there's no ethical boundary to be crossed there.
Well, she was going to break the law by...
But didn't you tell Mike that you might not have done it a second time, or you had some question about whether you should have done it?
Charlie, I have set questions about almost everything I've ever written, of course I had second questions. I thought, why did I get involved in that? I don't need that.
When have you crossed ethical boundaries?
That was one time. I think I tell in the book about writing the interview for Helen Gurley Brown.
Yeah,
Helen insisted that I would do an interview with a call girl. I couldn't find any call girls, and I went to all the guys I knew, the big swingers, and they'd sort of, I don't think they were just holding me off at arm's length. And we never could find any call girl who would talk. We would offer them, $500 to talk.
Yeah.
So finally, I had a friend who was sort of in the twilight zone. I sort of thought she might be in the business, and so finally I said to her, let me interview you as if you are in the business. And Helen loved this story to death. And then later Alan Pakula tried to hire me as an expert on call girls for when he was making the movie Clute, and I said, I have to tell you the truth, I don't know whether this girl was a call girl or not. So I mean, that's what I mean.
Is it harder to write the column today or much easier because you are so much better known? And
I think in some respects it's harder because, except now I feel it has a sort of a positive rhythm of its own, and people don't expect it to, be too, they don't expect it to slash and burn and do bad things like they expect from other columns. But there are plenty of other columns to do that. So I'm just in my dotage here, Charlie, doing the best I can.
What does the column mean to you? I mean, what is the column for you? Fun? The column is a means of communication. The column is a place where people sort of communicate about their friends.
Well, I love the column, and I love to write it. And I have more fun writing it than anything else. I would really miss it if I weren't doing it.
I would think that it might be, I mean, everybody that I've ever known that likes power especially loves the idea of knowing, is curious, number one, most of them, and they are curious about other people, what makes them tick. Jack Kennedy, who was notorious, according to Ben Bradley, for being interested in
gossip.
What's happening, gossip and everything else. And I bet it goes a long way back to Napoleon was interested in those kinds of things. And the idea is that you sit there at a certain place where people, because you have a column, because people know you know stuff, because people call you up and give you stuff for all kinds of reasons.
You're just talking about the addiction that you and I share.
I admit it.
Which is the news addiction.
Yeah.
I don't care how you dress it up. It can be R.W. Apple in the New York Times.
Right.
It can be you. It can be Mike Wallace. Or it can be me or somebody less grand than me. But it's all still, we're all news junkies is what we are.
And we're interested in what
and this
people
kind
are
of
doing.
Business is more addictive than any drug. I couldn't keep you from finding out what was on the news. The first thing you said when you came in the room a while ago to your
executive producer
friend is, what happened? What's
Did
happened since I've been here? I've been at 60 Minutes. What happened since I was incommunicado?
Exactly.
You're
exactly.
afraid you're going to miss something. And, gossip is just stories. No matter how we dress it up, it's a story of who did what, to whom, where the bodies are buried, where they might be buried, all that kind of stuff. And I think that that's just endemic to human nature.
Henry Luce once said, when they asked him about People magazine and Time magazine and the popularity of newsmakers' column, that kind of thing, he said, it goes back to the Bible. We've all been interested in stories about people. That's what it's about for a long, long time.
And that's why God, instead of writing the story of creation the way scientists wanted him to, decided he would make it Adam and Eve.
Exactly.
Because we could understand
and
it that way. That's right.
Took place.
Sin and the serpent and the whole thing.
So it became a story so people could.
And you know, people, lots, millions of people believe that it literally was true.
Does gossip work on television?
Sure. I mean,
you did it for a while.
Look at it working. I mean, we had this show on E! Entertainment, the Gossip Show. It ran for 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
It was a tremendous amount of fun, though I always thought of it more as a performance. I would get my little nothing thing that I was going to do and I would sort of dress it up as a little performance. And it was more important how I did it than what it was. But sure, it works. I mean, Winchell made it work on radio.
Yeah, but Winchell was a long time ago.
But nothing has changed. I mean, there's no difference.
But I don't know why it's not more often on television. I mean, I realize we got lots of outlets, and I don't see all of them. But at one point, you were... Yes.
Well, that's interesting what you're saying. I see what you're saying. You're saying, why isn't it bigger? Well, you remember in Network when they bring on the gossip columnist and Faye Dunaway... brings on the astrologist and the gossip columnist onto the evening news. Network was prescient in some ways. It's just that all of the evening newscasts have softened up. Whether you think they're not doing gossip, but they still have their pride. They have their little skirts swept up just out of the bud. But we are really into this infopainment stuff, and we're just eating it up.
And does that bother you, that the fact that the lines
saying,
are what?
Well, what you're saying about it not being done on television, it actually is being done a lot. It's being done even worse on the Internet.
Oh, sure, where there are no holes barred, because you also
There are no editors, no publishers, nobody to say don't do that.
Yeah.
So I find the Internet rather dangerous. I mean, the idea of at least having some break on... behavior is an appealing one to an old pagan Christian like me.
The book is called Natural Blonde. It is now number 7 on the New York Times bestseller list. It is Liz Smith's story. She has written about her own beginnings in Texas to a number of newspapers and magazines, worked on for Mike Wallace in television, now New York City, writing about her story. Thank you, my dear.
Thank you, Charlie.
Back in a moment. Stay with us.